recorder is now on, and despite a certain amount of conversation, the class is only just starting now, so I don't think I've cheated anybody out of his share of hearing it, even if he is in Timbuktu or some similarly distant place. I don't know if I've mentioned to you my idea that one of the reasons for things like recording this and putting everything up on the web page is the idea that potentially some bright person interested in the subject in China or India or Timbuktu can come across it and in effect have the same course you have for free, and then 10 years later when he's being a bright guy, risen to be an important businessman, and one of his colleagues said, you know any good law schools in the U.S.? Well, everybody knows the top law school is Santa Clara. I mean, I audited a class there once. So that's, I think, in general, the internet is a wonderful technology for giving information away and not a rather clumsy technology for selling it, which is why I think it is useful to figure out ways of achieving useful objectives by giving information away, which is sort of what it's good about. And I am now actually, is this, yep, you can see, lights, camera action. Is that clear enough for everybody? Can see it, or do I need to turn off any more lights? No? All right, don't have to pull down the blinds. All right, so what I actually wanted to do was to start by seeing if any of you had questions, if there were things in what we've done in the first half of the course, more or less, which didn't make sense to you or which you wanted to explore further. As I was saying before some of you came in, the nice thing when you're giving a public lecture about the question period is that you know that what you're talking about, at least one person of the audience is interested in. And so similarly here, before I start going through my summary, which is really the first half of the course squished down, let me see if there are particular points any of you wanted to explore. Are there? Yes? No? Maybe? Don't be shy. All right. So we start out with a very simple question. What does economics have to do with law? And I think the short answer is that the economist sees law as incentive, that the economist sees a legal system as determining what will happen to people if they do various things, and then in figuring out the consequences, you can't just say, well, they do this and this happens. You say, how will their behavior be altered by knowing that certain things will happen if you do things? And in a certain sense, that's pretty obvious. There's a famous, I think, 19th century English judge's quote, we hang men not so that they will not commit a murder, so that other people will not commit murders. That's not quite right, but it's something like that. And you can see that strain running through all of law, along with a sort of a parallel strain of trying to make moral arguments about what's right. But the economic perspective basically says, if we have this law, and I'm using law here very broadly, I'm including, you know, common law legal rules, and in principle I would include norms, and, you know, the rules set up by private arbitrators, legal rules is really broader than formal law, but call it a law, and rational individuals take the existence of this legal rule into account in deciding what will happen. And then in evaluating the legal rule, you want to evaluate in the context not of just what does it say, not of just what happens if you break it, but how will the world be different because people adjust to the fact that that legal rule is out there. And so you can think of it as three projects. The first is the one I just described. Take any legal rule, wherever it came from, figure out what its effects will be. The second one is a much more iffy project, which is to explain why the law is what it is. And that's really the project that I associate with what's referred to as the Posner conjecture, where Posner, back at the beginning of things, so to speak, which means, I suppose, now 30 or 40 years ago, when he wrote his Economic Analysis of Law, which I like to describe as a treatise masquerading as a textbook. And in that, he offered the conjecture that you could make sense out of the rules of the common law by thinking of them as a set of rules designed to maximize the size of the pie, to maximize somehow the total welfare of the society. And that's a conjecture, and as you'll see by the time you get to the end of the book in the course, I have somewhat mixed views as to whether the conjecture is right, but it's a very interesting guess anyway. A lot of the ways you explore things are making guesses and following them out. And then the final thing you could do with these tools is you might use them to figure out what you think the law ought to be. So you could say, look, our analysis tells us if you have this law, people will get killed. If you have this law, they won't, so let's have this law. And you could think of a lot of other more complicated versions of that. and obviously the economics by itself can't tell you what the law should be. You have to figure out what you regard as desirable results. Maybe you like people being shot. You know, if you're really worried about population issues, you could take a sort of an agnostic view to murder, keep down the population. But whatever your objectives are, the economic analysis provides a set of tools to say how could those objectives be accomplished by legal rules. And in the simple case where your objective is maximizing the size of the pie, whatever that means, then the tools that you develop to test Posner's conjecture can also be used to recommend, to say, well, nope, the law is not efficient, let's change it and make it efficient. That's one possible way you could use these ideas. Well, I say efficiency, this is the magic word, which runs through a lot of this discussion, even though Posner called it wealth maximization instead, just to confuse us all. So we want some way of evaluating legal rules, of evaluating lots of things, some way of evaluating the stimulus proposals, some way of evaluating tariffs, some way of evaluating changes in divorce laws, or anything, in a sense. One interesting question is, loosely speaking, does it make the world a better place? And that's a question people are always asking. They almost always believe they know the answer, and they almost always are wrong. I don't mean they have the wrong answer. I mean that most people who have an opinion on this subject could not really support that opinion against a serious inquiry. On either side, I think most people who think that the stimulus is good couldn't. Most people who think the stimulus is bad couldn't. Similarly for lots of other issues. In the first step is to figure out what you mean by good. To figure out, do you have some way in which you can say, world a better place? And economists basically, in my view, after giving up on persuading the rest of the world that economics is a positive science and therefore can't answer such questions, finally say, well, look, here's what we'll do. Here's the criterion of goodness, and it isn't perfect. But nobody else has a perfect one either. It's not too bad. So it comes close to what you want. And it's got the great virtue that we can answer questions with it. That we can say, if you define the size of the pie in this way, we can quite often show you good reasons to believe that tariffs reduce the size of the pie. Show you good reasons to believe that price control reduces the size of the pie. Perhaps show you good reasons to believe that some other government interventions, say that anti-monopoly law, increases the size of the pie. There are certainly arguments for that thesis. But it's in any case a definition which, while it doesn't just let you write down three equations and get all answers, comes a lot closer to that than just saying, do I like it? So the problem is that any of these changes we're concerned with are going to affect lots of people. And it would be nice if we had a change that made everybody better off, but those are in really short supply. So we need some way of summing up effects across people, of trying to decide, did it help you more than it hurt me? And the answer, which Alfred Marshall came up with a bit over 100 years ago, and I don't even remember what term he used for it. He didn't use the term efficiency either. That's sort of the popular modern term for it, was imagine you could somehow consider a change, the abolition of steel tariffs. Suppose there were some way of finding out from every person if that person was perfectly informed about the effects on him, how much he would pay either to get or prevent that change. That's a measure in terms of his own values, his own objectives, of the effect of the change on him. So we say, all right, if you knew all the effects of the stimulus proposal, you would be willing to pay $6,000 to kill it. But you would be willing to pay $4,000 to have it pass, and add that up over the whole population, and if we decide that the result is that on net, people by their own values benefit by $3 billion by the stimulus package, then it increases economic efficiency. If on net they lose by $4 billion, it decreases it. So it's a way, an imperfect way, in ways we've discussed, but a way of somehow putting some content into this idea of making the world a better place. And I'm not sure there are any real competitors. I mean, that's one of the issues that you can think of once. Because you can say, well, we know that happiness isn't perfectly related to dollar value. So you could say, all right, do the same thing, but weight poor people's dollars higher than rich people's dollars. Or find some other measure by which you can figure out how dollars relate to happiness. But it's very hard, at least for me, to think up a plausible legal mechanism that would really do that. Whereas the legal mechanism that does what I'm describing, the very simple one, is just private property and trade, because anytime something I've got is worth more to you, you make me an offer and you get it, and that's increasing economic efficiency, because something is now with someone who values it more. There are all sorts of problems. There's a semester's worth of problems with that that we discuss, but nonetheless, it's at least a starting point. I don't see a comparable starting point for the utilitarian alternative, and I'm not sure I can think of any other good competitors. So the conclusion that I offer is that if you think about it as a normative criterion, as a way of saying what's good, all right, norms are about good and bad, right and wrong, as opposed to positive statements, normative statements. If you consider it as a normative criterion, it makes sense to think of efficiency as a proxy for what the 19th century philosophers called utility and what we would think of crudely as happiness. So we say, look, we're going to use, it's not perfect, but on the whole, if the amount I would pay to get this change is greater than the amount you'd pay to stop it, that probably means that it makes me happier than it makes you unhappy, some over lots of changes, and if we're lucky, all of us will be at least a little bit happier. That's the kind of argument. And we prefer to use that as a proxy, both because it's much easier to measure dollar value than utility, because every time anybody makes or accepts an offer, he's just given a measure of dollar value. If I'm willing to pay $10 for these glasses, that shows they're worth at least $10 to me. And because it's easier to create rules to maximize it, because, as I say, the market provides a good first approximation, at least, to maximizing it. And then the claim, which is a disputable claim, but one that at least I'm making, is that the legal rules that maximize economic efficiency are usually close to the ones that would maximize happiness if we only knew enough to do it. If we're thinking about it not as deciding what we ought to have, but what we will have as a predictive criterion, then I want to claim that efficiency is a better one than happiness. Because if you think of all of the levers that affect the law, of people lobbying to get laws passed, of people litigating to persuade judges to change their interpretation of the law, stuff like that, what really is going to matter in all of these things, almost all of these things, is not how happy or unhappy a change makes, but how much somebody's willing to spend to try to get it. That's the way in which your preferences actually come out on the political marketplace, as it were, or the legal marketplace, trying to affect things. And the only exception I can think of is that if you imagine a legal system where the judges were all utilitarians, and where the judges said, each time I make a decision, I'll try to figure out if it makes you happier or less happy. It'd be very hard for them to do that well. I mean, they probably would mess up on it. But that's the only case I can think of where you might predict a legal set of legal rules designed for happiness instead of for efficiency. Might be designed for something entirely different, of course. I'm not saying those are the only alternatives. I'm just saying between happiness and efficiency. You could make quite a plausible case for saying that the real rule is we have those legal rules that maximize the power and stability of the government, because countries that didn't collapse got replaced by ones that did. That would be sort of an evolutionary theory of law. So not one we're going to be using here, but I don't want to claim that there are no alternative theories, just that I think efficiency makes more sense than utility if you're looking for a predictive criteria. So, in summary of this chunk of it, economics is an approach to understanding behavior which assumes individuals have objectives and tend to take the actions that best achieve them. That's what we call rationality. Another term to confuse people, because a lot of people think of rationality as how you think, not getting the right answer. The economic analysis of law asks what the consequences are of legal rules, allowing for how rational individuals will respond, because we're economists, we expect people to be rational. That could explain observed rules, maybe, if Posner's right. And it might also be one way in which you might decide how to choose rules to design a legal system to make it efficient or to achieve some other objective that's important to you. That then gets us, what does economic efficiency mean? It's the size of the pie. Marshall's version is sum of dollar value to all affected. Dollar value doesn't mean dollars people get. It means the dollars they would pay for something. So if you hand me $100 and grab this laptop, I end up with more dollars, but with a net loss, because the laptop's worth more than $100, even though it would give me an excuse to get the newest one, which is better. And the problems with that definition are, first, that it accepts individual valuations. It assumes that you know what's good for you, so to speak. Second, it only counts the value to people as revealed in their actions, so even if an ancient tree has in some metaphysical sense a value of its own, it's not going to show up in our calculations. It'll only show up if human beings value it. And it treats a dollar as of the same value to everyone. So those are sort of the three clearest ways in which it's an imperfect criterion. On the other hand, my responses to those are that my actions are the best available measure of value to me, even if an imperfect one. I know myself much better than an external observer can. That the only actors we've got available to control the system are people, unless you believe that God is meddling from above, in which case it's not our problem anymore. But if we imagine a society run by people, the trees don't get to vote, the trees don't get to bribe anybody, they're just there and they are only become relevant insofar as people value. That for the final point about dollar being of different values, Marshall's argument is yes, but most policies will affect a whole bunch of different people with a high, wide range of values for dollars, so average it out and the people who lose are probably value dollars about as much as the people who gain, so no, we're all right. And a different argument, which has been was made first, as far as I know, by Quang Ung, who's the only utilitarian I know personally. He's a Vietnamese-Australian economist, bright, interesting guy, and then was reinvented independently by a couple of people at Harvard many years later who had never read Ung. And the basic argument is that you can show, you can make plausible arguments to show that tweaking the legal system is a costly way of redistributing income. That basically, the problem with redistributing income by taxing rich people and giving it to poor people is it reduces the incentive to be rich and increases the incentive to be poor. But if you redistribute income by tweaking the legal system so it favors poor people over rich people, it has exactly the same effect. And in addition, since you're moving, since you're not putting up efficient rules, there is some additional loss in the fact that the dollar gained to one is less than the dollar lost to the other. That's the guts of Quang Ung's argument, and it says, therefore, if you're in favor of dealing with this problem, you should deal with it by a straight tax and transfer system of some sort rather than by tweaking the legal system. Questions? Go back for a moment. Any questions so far? Stop. Yes?
How, for example,
You could tweak the legal system by saying that if a poor person committed a tort against a rich person, the damage payment that the poor person owed was scaled down by the ratio of their income. That would be a simple way. The only real-world example of this I know is that in Finland, things like traffic fines are defined as a fraction of your income. So a very wealthy person might pay a $5,000 traffic fine, say. But that would be an example. But another example would be if a judge said tenants are usually poorer than landlords, which is a somewhat risky rule because there are places like Manhattan where it isn't true, where there are a lot of very wealthy people who are tenants. But suppose you say, I'm in, you know, a low-income part of Chicago, and I'm pretty sure that the people living in these not very attractive apartment buildings are poorer than the people who own them. So therefore, in interpreting, in legal disputes between landlords and tenants, I will follow a rule of consistently favoring the tenants. That as long as there's any argument for their case, I'll decide for them. And you could say, well, if the tenants are poorer, and you say, well, that's going to benefit the tenants at the expense of the landlords, the economist has persuaded me the tenants will gain less than the landlords lose, but that's all right, because the tenants value dollars more. So those would be examples where you could imagine trying to tweak a legal system for that purpose. And as I say, the argument, it seems to me, is that, yes, you could do that, but assuming you've got the political muscle to do that, you've probably also got the political muscle to just tax some rich people and give the money to poor people, and that looks like a better system in a whole lot of ways. So, I should say, one of the interesting possibilities, which you people may or may not observe, in terms of the development of political divisions over the next couple of decades, is the possibility of what... There are actually two interesting possibilities. What I'm thinking of was one of the economists here a few years ago gave a talk on what I think he described as something like libertarian redistributionism. And what he was proposing was a system which was extreme laissez-faire except for income redistribution by the government. And part of the argument was that, really the argument I'm making here in a sense, once you do whatever level of income redistribution by direct tax and transfer you think is appropriate, you then eliminate from the discourse all of the arguments of the form do X because it helps the poor. And since arguments of the form do X because it helps the poor are usually not true, if you think about the farm program, for example, that when people are arguing for a farm program, they naturally trot out the poor family farm. You then look at the real statistics and the median farm is worth more than $1 million. All right, so that you've... Furthermore, the farm program largely acts to raise the price of food. That's one way you benefit farmers. food is something that poor people spend more of their income on than rich people, so raising the price of food is a regressive tax. So that would be one example, and his argument would be that if you could somehow rule out of all of the arguments everything else helping the poor, that you could then have a prosperous, successful, very free market society and just help the poor by helping the poor. So it was an interesting proposal. But I could imagine a American political landscape 20 years from now where one of the sides is taking that position. It would sort of be. Just as, for example, as you may know, it used to be the case that the Democrats were the pro-free trade party and the Republicans the anti-free trade party. In fact, it's sort of odd because free trade nowadays politically tends to be seen as something that's sort of anti-labor and pro-management, but traditionally the Republicans were seen as the party of big business, and the big businesses wanted protective tariffs to protect their American market from foreign competitors. So political, one sort of tends looking around and say, we know what left and right are. But that's just at a given instant in time, and I think it could be quite interesting if in various ways you ended up with you think of a lot of possible coalitions among different dividing lines people divide on. But anyway, that's one. So other comments, questions? Let's keep going. All right, so first pass of externalities, and this is externalities as of about 1960, roughly, the accepted view. What is an externality? It's a positive negative cost that one person's acts impose on another. Under circumstances where if you're imposing a cost, you don't need his consent to do it. All right? You could say that when I hire you to do a job, I'm imposing a cost on you. After all, you can't sit home and play World of Warcraft from 9 to 5 anymore. You've got to come work for me. But I'm not imposing it. I can only get you to do that if I offer you enough money so that you're willing to give up your World of Warcraft game. And similarly, you could say I'm providing a benefit to you when I sell you something, but again, you only get it if you're willing to pay me for it, and that means I've got to get a sufficient reward, so I'm willing to give it to you. So those aren't externalities. But the externality is the case where I take an action, you're worse off, didn't require your consent to do it. I take an action, you're better off. No way that I could refuse to make you better off in a way such that you would have to basically pay me to do it. A point which I think isn't made clear enough in discussions of this is that the statement that something is an externality is partly a statement about physical reality and partly a statement about the legal system. So that, for example, in a world without copyright law, when I write a novel and sell one copy, now the person who got that copy can, assuming we've got cheap photocopying, say, or suppose this is online, he can make lots and lots of copies for other people. I provided a benefit to them, and I could keep the first guy, but as long as I want to sell it to one person, I can't keep the rest from getting it. In a world with copyright law, we've now converted the right to make that copy into a property right. It belongs to me, the author, so that's no longer an externality. Might be other externalities, but not that one. And so partly it's the statement that there are certain cases where it would be extremely difficult or impossible to arrange things such that I had to get the permission of people affected. So if you take the case of if you're worried about global warming, it should occur to you that you yourself are a carbon dioxide source. Every time you breathe out, you're breathing out carbon dioxide. So carry the argument far enough, and we say, all right, you're imposing a negative externality, at least on everybody in Bangladesh and the Maldives, which are the two places which are low enough lying, so they'll flood if the ocean goes up a few feet. Parts of them will. Parts of Bangladesh will. So therefore, you're not allowed to breathe until you have unanimous permission from everybody living anywhere low-lying in the world. That would be carrying the argument all the way, and we say the reason that's an externality is there isn't any plausible institutional mechanism by which you can actually have before you breathe, you buy permission from those people. Even if your breathing is worth more to you than the effect of a tiny amount of carbon dioxide is to them, which almost certainly it is. On the other hand, partly to say about the legal system, that a sort of standard example would be the case of a radio broadcast where I can't control who listens to it. But you could imagine a system where it's illegal to listen to my broadcast without having paid me a licensing fee, and where I've got spies who sneak around tape recorders, and if they record you listening to my program, maybe my program is going to have some high-pitched coded signals that you can't even hear, but the tape recorder can hear, so they can spot the cheaters, and they find out you're a cheater, and you owe me a $10,000 fine because you stole my program. You can imagine that's a pretty costly implement. So the point I'm making is that the statement is an externality. In a sense, it's a statement about how we've organized the legal system, but in some cases, it would be very hard to avoid this being an externality. Maybe impossible to avoid this being an externality. What's the problem with externalities? From the economist standpoint, the problem is not you're getting something you're not paying with. That's great. I like getting things. It's not I'm harming you without your permission. It's too bad, but world's like that. Things are bad. When it rains, I get harmed without my permission too, if I happen to be out without an umbrella. The problem with externalities is that they mess up the mechanism that gives you efficient outcomes. Because part of that mechanism is that in deciding how to produce steel, I figure out the least costly way of doing it because I got to pay for all my inputs. And people only sell me to an input at a price which compensates them for the cost of giving me that input. But one of the inputs I'm not paying for is clean air. All right, I'm taking clean air, pumping sulfur dioxide into it out of my smokestack. That imposes a cost on people downwind. Don't need their permission to do it. Therefore, I ignore that cost. Therefore, even if there was a cheaper way of producing steel, even if I could, at a much lower cost, filter out that carbon, that sulfur dioxide, even if I could filter it at a cost lower than the damage it did, why should I bother? I'm not the one, I'm not living downwind. I'm not the one who's bearing that cost. So the first problem is that you produce the wrong way. That you don't, you don't have to, maybe there is no way of preventing it, but in many cases, that you don't produce at the lowest cost mechanism, technology, bundle of inputs, whatever you want to call it, because some of the costs you have to pay for and some of them you don't, and you're only concerned with the ones you have to pay for. The second problem is that because you're not bearing all the costs of production, the price you're willing to sell at in a competitive market where your price tends to get driven down to about cost is going to be lower than the real cost of production. So that means if you think about price as a signaling system, if you say, how do I know how hard it is to grow wheat? Suppose I'm a benevolent person and I say, I want to decide whether to use wheat or rye in baking bread. And I like the taste about the same, so I'd like to decide to use whichever flour costs other human beings the least to produce. How do I find out? Look at the price on the grocery shelf. That price reflects the sum of all of the costs borne by people in getting that grain out of the ground, milled, packaged, transported, and so forth. So that way, all I got to do in that case is to be selfish, just buy the cheapest stuff, and I will, as Adam Smith would have said, be led as by an invisible hand to do a good that is no part of my intention. But, so that sort of is the underlying logic of why the sort of first approximation, the market gives you the efficient outcome. But then it breaks down with externalities because now it turns out, let us suppose, that milling rye produces pollution in the rivers that you dump the waste product from. Milling wheat doesn't. So rye is cheaper in the marketplace than wheat, but it's really more expensive to produce. And the result is that people substitute rye for wheat even when the wheat is just as good and in real terms is cheaper. So more generally, the whole mechanism, if you sort of think of the market as a decentralized computer, which is really what it is, that the mechanism by which it calculates how to do things is messed up by the fact that some of the signals are wrong, that some of the price signals are leaving out some of the costs that ought to go into those prices. So that's really the second problem. Yeah?
How do you calculate the cost of the pollution in that example? Is it just what it would take to clean up?
That would be an upper bound, but you would also have to ask whether it was worth cleaning up. So you would have to, in any case, in principle, it would be hard to do in many cases, but you could say, look, take air pollution. One of the things that air pollution does is to make clothes get dirty faster. So you can say, well, how much more do people end up spending on dry cleaners or on laundries or whatever in polluted versus unpolluted? Another effect of air pollution is, in some form of air pollution, is to reduce life expectancy, to make certain illnesses more likely. So we say, all right, let's try to do an estimate of this air pollution results in so many years lost life. What do we believe people value their own lives at? And that would give us a number for the cost of pollution. All of these things are very hard in the real world. And they're hard partly because many things have effects in both directions. So that, for example, almost no discussion of global warming notes the fact that global warming is in many ways a good thing. Right? If you live in an area which is now cold enough so you can barely grow crops in it, it'll get a lot, on average, depends how the global warming, it's not going to be uniform, but if you just take this case of temperature going up. In fact, people very rarely notice that the world is extraordinarily warm now and has been for the last 12,000 years. We're, in fact, in an interglacial. Most of the last million years, there were sheets of ice over large parts of the area human beings now live in. And there have been occasional, like a few thousand years, and this is a long one, this one's running like 12 or 14,000 years, old, interglacials. The way my wife, who's a geologist and everyone knows about this, likes to put it, is that the world has swung repeatedly in the last million years between London, the location of London being warm enough to have hippos there, and a mile of ice over London and Chicago. So in that sense, we're in a warm climate at the moment, and indeed, I've even seen the argument that the only thing that saved us from the ice age has been human effects pushing in carbon dioxide. I don't know how plausible that is. But if you think about it, putting carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has desirable and undesirable effects. And if you really wanted to figure it out, you'd have to add up all of them, and that would be a really horrendous problem. But what really happens is if you think you don't like global warming, you forget about all the desirable ones and only add up the undesirable. I don't know if I mentioned to you, my first piece of economic research long before the global warming argument was on population issues. And what I was trying to do was to figure out the net externality from having a baby. Because people at that time, to some extent still, but much more of that, this would have been early 70s, were very concerned that population growth was dooming the world. And you had serious predictions that in the 60s or 70s there would be mass world famines with, you know, hundreds of millions of people dying. Never happened. But that was the concern then. And from an economist standpoint, the argument is that you have a baby, that baby in various ways imposed costs on the rest of the world. So I decided, let's try to estimate it. But of course, I wanted to estimate both sides, the costs and the benefits. And so I tried to make estimates for both the costs and the benefits that one more child produced, and I concluded that the numbers were sufficiently uncertain so I couldn't tell whether the sum was positive. If anybody's curious, it's still on my webpage. It was a pamphlet the Population Council did called Laissez-faire in Population, the Least Bad Alternative. And I was hired to write it by the head of the Population Council, very nice guy, who I don't think was particularly pro-laissez-faire. I think it was just that he was the sort of person who thought that all arguments ought to be heard. So he thought it would be nice to get somebody who was pro-free market to give that perspective of what was then a hot issue. But anyway, but that's the same issue, basically. But for as long as you're just doing economic theory, it's easy. You just say whatever the cost of the pollution is. If you are trying to apply it, it gets really hard. But conceptually, it's pretty clear, I think. And if you can clean it up, then it's either the damage done by not cleaning it up or the cost of cleaning it up, whichever is lower. Right? Because those are your alternatives. So that's the problem. Notice that there is a category of externalities we don't care about, and those are ones which are not net externalities. So-called pecuniary externalities. And those are the cases where my action harms you but benefits him by an equal amount. And the simple example of that is competition. So that I become the 101st physician, my doing so slightly drives down the price that the other 100 physicians can charge for the 10 patients a day they're seeing. The result is that each visit costs $49 instead of $50. The physicians are very unhappy because my becoming a physician has imposed a negative externality on them totaling $1,000 a day, quite a large externality, $250,000 a year. But I say that's all right because every dollar you lost, your patient gained by paying you a dollar less. Why should I? I've actually been observing this phenomenon in sort of an amusing context on World of Warcraft because you've got these auction houses where people sell things. And where you've got some particular to other people in the game for virtual money. I mean, this is none of this is real money. And you have people who sort of say to other people selling, you know, why are you messing up the market for us? You know, why don't you be a responsible citizen to keep prices high the way we're keeping them instead of coming, I mean, you know, undercutting us for your, you know, your greedy attempt to steal some money? And it doesn't seem to occur to them that every dollar or whatever it is, gold piece that they lose when someone undercuts them is gained by the customer who just bought the thing that they sold. Sort of, the customers aren't really there, it's only the sellers who count. Anyway, so the argument then is this is why competition is not important. There, in fact, is a common law case from like the 15th century, some really old case where the court, where somebody tried to sue someone for competing with him. I think it was a school, and the court said, no, that's not a tort. They never heard of externalities, but they got the law right. So let's review what we've just done in this chunk. Why is the market efficient in the simple case? Because the price system transmits human costs in dollar form, with the result that the least dollar cost way of producing an automobile is also the least human cost, where the cost is labor that could have been used for something else, input that could have been used for something else, and so forth and so on. And the result of that is that everything is produced if and only if it's worth producing, because you only produce it if someone will pay you for you at least what it costs to produce, and in the least costly way, because any way of reducing the total inputs for your output will save you money and make you better off. And everything ends up in the hands of whoever values it most, because he's the guy who bids the most for it. That's the sort of simple, ignoring transaction costs, ignoring externalities, ignoring a whole bunch of problems, but that's the first approximation picture of how a market works. Externalities mess it up twice. First, because you're not including your external costs, so you're really producing in the least private cost, not the least cost way. You're ignoring the cost that you don't have to pay. And second, the price that you sell your output for no longer accurately measures the cost of producing it. It only measures the private cost, because if the private cost is $100 and you'll pay me $110 and I'm producing $20 worth of pollution, make money producing it and selling it at $110 or $109 or $101, anything. You could solve the first problem with regulation. You could solve the first problem by, if you have a sufficiently well-informed and benevolent regulator, he can say, you have to put scrubbers on your smokestacks, you don't. You've got to use low-sulfur coal, you don't. In each case, decide what the efficient way of producing it is. However, that still would leave the second problem, because now, assuming that the optimal level of control still leaves some externalities, it probably will, because it's very costly to eliminate all of it, that externality is still not being priced into the cost of the goods. So you still have an efficiency even there. Pigou's elegant solution, which persuaded everybody in economics for 30 years or so, is that you charge the person who produces an externality for the cost of the externality. So you say, if I'm polluting the river, and if we can calculate that my pollution does $1 million worth of damage a year, send me a bill for $1 million a year. If I can cut down the pollution, just fine, that'll cut my bill. If I can't, I pay $1 million a year. That goes into the cost of my output, so my output is properly priced. It's too bad that the river is polluted, but the very fact that I chose to pollute it means that the cost of stopping it was more than $1 million a year, and we don't want to spend $2 million solving $1 million problem. So that's Pigou's argument. And with that, you still have to have some mechanism for determining what that cost is, your problem you're raising. You still have to worry about whether that mechanism is benevolent, whether they'll really figure out the cost or figure out what they've been bribed to say or what will benefit the current party in power or something like that. All of those problems still exist, but at least you've solved a sizable chunk of the problem. You've made it a much simpler problem. And in fact, one way of viewing tort law is to see tort law as a Pigouvian tax, because we say, look, the tortfeasor must make his victim whole. What does that mean? It means he's got to pay an amount equal to the damage done. Pausing for just a moment. Are there any problems with that story? Putting aside the Kosian problems we haven't gotten to yet. Does tort law in fact mean that when I impose an externality, I will pay an amount equal to the damage done? Why not?
Well, because oftentimes the damage done to a person includes more than just the tort that's actually
That is, first, there are court costs, that's right. Second, tort law tends to focus on easily measurable damages, so it might well leave out sort of pain and suffering kinds of things. You know, there's this bumper sticker, hit me, I need the money. Nobody really believes that, or else nobody I've met really believes that. It's a great line, but you really know that the amount of hassle involved just to get your car fixed again isn't worth it. And furthermore, tort law doesn't catch all torts. So as long as the system isn't perfect, you commit a tort, you really only have an 80% chance of being sued and losing. So that means that on average, you're only paying 80% of your damages. So again, the Pigou's approach is sort of a good first approximation view of tort law, but there are clearly glitches in that. And as we will see much later in the course, how to include the costs of suing people, the cost in general of enforcing law, turns out to be a rather complicated question. It's not just as simple as add them up as one of the costs. Because after all, one way of avoiding those costs is not to sue them. And the Pecuniary externalities don't count for the reason we went through, but rent seeking, which is my spending resources, transferring money from you to me, does count because I have an incentive to spend those resources even if the net amount is a wash. So we're worse off. If I spend $1,000 stealing $2,000 from you, I'm $1,000 better off, you're $2,000 worse off, net loss, and yet I've acted rationally because I'm better off. And it's worth noting that from one perspective, tort litigation is itself rent-seeking. I'm spending resources trying to get you to pay me damages. That might be justified if it achieves some useful objective, such as enforcing a Pigouvian tax. But because it is a cost, it means that there is at least some presumption for leaving costs where they fall. There's some presumption for saying, unless making someone else liable for your cost achieves a clearly useful function, don't. Because if you do, both sides will spend resources trying to control how much I do or don't have to pay you. Coase's critique of Pigou. This is why we are now shifting to 1961 or 62 or somewhere around there, which is when the famous dinner party at Aaron Director's house happened. And Coase's argument is that an externality isn't really A imposes costs on B. That's a mistaken understanding. It is really A and B take actions whose joint effect is a cost. And the simple example is airport noise. That however noisy the airplanes are, it doesn't much matter if all that's underneath the landing path is a wheat field. It matters a lot if what's under the landing path is residential housing. It would matter even more if there was a recording studio under the flight path. So really, it's decisions by both parties, one of whom we think of as the tortfeasor and one as the victim, which determine it. That means that we would have to worry about the incentives of both parties, and that therefore making one party liable might give the wrong result if the other party is the one who could most easily reduce the problem. All right, that's a simple version. So that's the nothing works step of Coase's argument, is that if we listen to Pigou and we say that the airplane either will be fined by the state or will be tort damage to the people underneath for making noise, the result might well be that the airline spend $100 million reducing the noise when it would have cost only $10 million to use all of that land for wheat fields instead of residential housing. So there is no general way in which the Pigou is going to... Pigou might give you the right answer, but there's no way of counting on it. Second step in Coase's argument, say, wait a minute, how come the airline can't talk to the guys underneath it? Why can't the airline just buy that land and then rent it out for wheat fields? So the second step is, as long as the transaction costs of the needed transaction are low enough, you'll always get to the efficient outcome. Because if the government says the airlines are liable, but if it's cheaper to change the use of the land, then the airlines will pay whoever owns the land to change the use of the land, and that will be a net gain for both parties. So that's the Coase theorem. Coase theorem says, given if we have some definition of who has a right to do what, and if transaction costs are sufficiently low, we'll always get the efficient outcome. Because as long as we have it, there is some deal that produces net benefits. If there's a deal that produces net benefits, there's some way of dividing those net benefits up so that everybody needed for the deal gains. So zero transaction costs will happen. That then gets you into realizing what is, in a sense, the bottom line of the Coasean argument, that it's really the transaction costs that are the problem. It's really the fact, not that you have an externality, whatever that means, but the fact that getting to the efficient outcome involves costly and difficult transactions. You therefore may not get there. That's the end of it. So then you can think of the real problem as the transaction costs. What's the conclusion of our analysis of externalities? That the Pigouvian solution is a special case. It describes the case where we already know who the least cost avoider is and where we can externally measure the damage. Notice that the Coasean, the bargaining solution, doesn't require any external measure of damage, because in the bargaining solution, the way we find out how much you're hurting me is by how much I'm willing to pay you to stop. Or alternatively, by how much you'll have to pay me to let you continue, according to which way the rule starts. The Coase theorem gives us the special case where transaction costs are low, in which case we don't need an external measure, we just define property rights and leave it to market transactions. Coasean analysis gives us the general case, starting with some definition of legal rights, some set of transaction costs that make certain moves costly or undoable, what inefficiencies will result, among the possible ways we might define the legal rights which lead to the best results, where those different ways of doing it would include property rules, liability rules, rules where supermajorities can make decisions. You can think of lots of different possible. So if we were designing a legal system, and we spend one chapter on a tiny bit of a legal system, what's our general procedure? Consider a possible legal rule, starting with this rule. Consider a possible outcome that might be efficient. How would we get to that outcome from this rule? Repeat for all possible efficient outcomes. See what's going to keep us from doing it. That's the spaghetti diagram, which is the sort of simple version of this, where we consider four different legal rules we might have, four different outcomes we might end up with, one of which it turns out we never want, one at the bottom, because there's no point in both having a spark arrester and clover, because once you've got clover, it won't burn, so we don't need a spark arrester. And from each of those, we can say, how would we get from this starting point to that end point? How good is starting point one? Well, that depends how likely we think each of endpoints A, B, and C is to be the right one, and how difficult these various steps are. Similarly for two, three, and four. And in principle, you could then, if you only knew enough facts, grind through the numbers and say, all right, rule two is the best rule. So to summarize that chapter, the problem is externalities. The solution Pigou we went through, the critique by Coase that it depends on decisions by two people or more. Sometimes they should both adjust, sometimes one, sometimes the other. Pigou's solution requires you to know who ought to adjust and what the costs are, and that it's a case where only one person should adjust. And the alternative Coasean approach is to define who has a right and allow bargaining if transactions are low enough, and the implications for the law is the analysis that we went through for this one small case in that chapter of trying to find which initial definition of rights averaged over the many cases you're going to actually apply it to minimizes the sum of the costs of getting to the efficient outcome, which is, may involve bargaining costs of various sorts, and the cost of not getting to the efficient outcome and therefore having some inefficient, less desirable outcome. But worked out in agonizing detail for our simple example. So any questions before I go on to insurance? No. Yes? No. Insurance, we start out with the idea of risk aversion, which I want to argue is a poorly chosen term. It really is risk aversion in money, and what it really amounts to is not that you dislike risk, but that you value money less when you have more of it. You value additional dollars less when you have more of it, which I think is a plausible description of how most of us behave. I'd be a lot more careful about penny pinching in various ways if my income were half what it is. One problem with insurance is moral hazard, that in effect insurance creates an externality because now things I do that change the risk of my house or my factory burning down provide costs or benefits to the insurance company because they affect the chance it's going to have to pay for it. That leads to inefficient choices just as in any other externality. And eventually, the guy who buys the insurance is paying for those inefficiencies because the insurance company is going to adjust its rates until it covers its costs. On the other hand, and this is another point which often is not made, moral hazard can be a feature as well as a bug because what it really means is transferring some of the incentive to somebody else, the person has the externality, but if, as Coase tells us, outcomes are jointly caused, then it might be that the other person you're transferring the incentive to is actually in a better position than you are to control it. And one example, which I offer, I think, in the book, is large corporation has many, many factories. It doesn't need to risk spread. It can risk spread internally because it's going to average out across its factories. Its problem is how it gets its employees to do their job. Because the individual manager of the factory deciding how much to spend on safety may correctly calculate that if he holds down, if he pays an inefficiently low amount to avoid low probability, high cost outcomes like the factory burning down, the result is that almost certainly nothing will happen during the several years he's running the factory, and then he'll have a gold star on his report card. Look, he kept costs down better than anybody else. Let's promote him. And if by any chance the factory does burn down, that's a $10 million loss to his employer, and it's going to cost him something. He might lose his job, but it's going to cost him a lot less than $10 million. So therefore, he's getting, in effect, more of the gain than the cost. Therefore, the company has a problem giving him an incentive to do a good job. So they say, we'll take care of that problem. We're going to insure it and tell the insurance company they can tell us what to do, basically. So that's And I suggested that that might explain some of the service contracts on things like washing machines, if you believe that the seller can do a better job of arranging to get it repaired than you can. Adverse selection, which is the other problem that sort of goes in the same bundle. It's not really specifically an insurance problem. That's one place it occurs. But it's the same sort of problem in having to do with asymmetric information this time, both with things that aren't exactly externalities but sort of are. And the asymmetric information is where you have a buyer and a seller and one of them has information about the product the other doesn't have, and they have no believable way of conveying that information. And there the used car market is sort of the standard example ever since Akerlof wrote his article on that, where since it's much more likely that I'll accept your offer if my car is a lemon than if it's a cream puff, you make the offer knowing that probably if it's a cream puff it'll be turned down, therefore you make an offer which is an appropriate offer for a lemon, or maybe a lemon with 10% chance of being a cream puff. At that low an offer, the cream puff guy is almost certain to turn it down, so the result is that lemons sell, which is fine, they sell at lemon prices, but that the cream puff that's worth more to the buyer than the seller never gets sold. That's a simple example, and I think I discussed the problems with genetic testing as one example of that. The next thing we covered was ex post ex ante, which is simply seems to me a useful sort of different angle to look at legal rules from, and things other than legal rules as well, employment contracts in particular. And the real question is, you want to get people to work hard, or you want people to drive safely, you want to influence people's behavior in some way. And there are two approaches to doing it. One of them is to say, we will reward or punish you for observed behavior. We will pay you only if you come in at 9 and stay at your desk until 5. The other way is we will reward or punish you for the outcome that we want to create or prevent. We won't pay you. We don't care whether you come in at 9 or not. Nobody makes me come in at 9. But we will reward or punish you according to whether you sell cars if you're a salesman, according to whether you write books if you're an author, that sort of thing. And according to how well your books sell if you're an author, that's a further outcome measurement thing. So the advantage of controlling output as a way of giving people an incentive either to work hard or to drive safely, either create positive results, prevent negative results, is first that if you're thinking about auto accidents, you can, where you're punishing people for behaving badly, you can use small punishments often if you're controlling the input, because driving fast only very occasionally causes an accident. So therefore, the expected cost of my driving fast is not $100,000, it's $20. I can pay a $20 fine, I'll pay it in the mail, no trouble, even a $100 fine. Whereas if you do it by output, you say I'm only going to punish you when there's an accident, then you've got to punish me by seizing my house and everything I own and locking me up for 5 years or something like that to get a large enough punishment, much more costly. And one sort of side point that I've made before, but I want to repeat, when I talk about more and less efficient punishments, I really mean cost per unit of punishment. So that the question is not, is the total cost of this punishment more than that? Because after all, if this punishment is a $10 fine and that punishment is execution, one execution will substitute for an awful lot of $10 fines as a way of giving people incentive not to do things. So you really want to know per dollar of deterrence, as it were, how much does it cost? And one further advantage of controlling the output is that the guy, the actor, the guy you're trying to control, probably has better information on what he's doing than you do. So he knows not only did he come in 9 to 5, we don't need a time clock if he's monitoring himself, but did he spend that time daydreaming or working? I know when I'm driving, am I paying attention, which the cop doesn't see until I run anything into something. Furthermore, I may have information on what I should do, because I may know how good or bad a driver I am in what ways, which the court doesn't have. On the other hand, some of the things I know might not be true, so that could be an argument for the other way, for the court making me not drive when I'm drunk, even though maybe I believe I'm perfectly safe when I'm drunk. In practice, legal rules often use both, and in fact, I suggested that for things where pure ex post was too costly, the efficient thing was usually a combination of as much ex post as you could do at a reasonable cost plus ex ante. And I suggested that one could explain punishment for attempted murder or for attempts in general as an ex ante punishment for the attempt plus an ex post punishment for the successor. And one further complication is that input and output aren't always clearly defined, because you could think of your speed as the output of how hard you step on the gas. Well, they're not monitoring that, they're monitoring the effect, but it's the input to whether you have an accident. Questions? Ex post ex ante. Just a useful way of thinking about a bunch of issues, I think.
So a driver with a sports car who's, I don't know, has exceptional reflexes, he should be charged less than?
I'm saying that if the driver, in fact, is a very good driver, then a speed limit rule will over-deter him. Because really, when he's driving 80, he's no damage, no danger to anybody. A punishment for accident will get the right deterrence, assuming he knows how good a driver is. He still won't drive 90, because that's the point at which he does start becoming dangerous. All right? So that to the extent that people differ in ways that the court system can't easily recognize and measure, but that the people know about. Now, if you punish for the output you're trying to prevent, each of them has an incentive to figure out how best to keep down that output, whereas if you punish for the input, you're making them all do the same thing. Right. Just consider a much simpler example. Suppose we're talking about authors, and suppose we're considering, we've got, as has sometimes happened with some series, where rather than having the author just write the book and get royalties on it, the author is an employee. Maybe he's doing the 73rd Tom Swift book, and he's got instructions from the firm on what are the rules about Tom Swift books. And we've got two options. One of them is to say, come in 9 to 5 and spend that time working. And the other is to say, we will pay you per page of acceptable manuscript produced. Well, it happens that some authors really work best at 2 in the morning. 9 to 5, they don't know that. When the guy says, I work best at 2 in the morning and you're closed, so I'll just stay home and work at home. If you're paying him by hours worked, well, you can tell us how many hours you work, but I won't believe you. Paying you by output, fine. You can do it whenever you like. So, all right, game theory. There's a large body of mathematics, starting basically with von Neumann and Morgenstern's book. I think there's some articles a little before that. And what it tries to do is create general ways of describing games, if possible, general enough so that one description will cover all or at least many games. Create a definition of what a solution to a game means, and show you how to find the solution to any particular game. That's sort of the objective. And game is very defined very broadly. That when you're selling gemstones on the auction house in World of Warcraft, you're engaged in a game. You're making decisions. The other sellers may cut the price under your price, and so forth and so on. What would a solution be? That's not at all clear. It might be a description of how every player ought to play to make himself to win best. It might be a description of how people will play. It might be very useful if you want to play against them to know what mistakes they would make. That gets too hard, so typically in game theory, you're assuming that the players in some sense play perfectly. And it turns out that since game theory is generally not about how many hours does it take to figure out what move to make, but only about what move should you make, that you usually assume implicitly that people have unlimited calculation ability. All right? And it turns out that from that perspective, chess is a trivial game. That if only you had a big enough computer, you could program it to work out all alternatives all the way to the end of the game, and then just follow those trails that lead to your winning. And so how can we describe a game? And one answer, which I think goes to von Neumann, though someone may have done it first, is by a strategy matrix. So what we say is, we will define what a player is doing by his choice of strategy. And what's a strategy? A strategy is a complete description of what he will do in every situation he may actually be confronted with in the game. So that I'm a bridge player, my strategy says, if my hand consists of the following cards, and I'm the dealer, make this bid. For all possible cards that it could consist of, right? So take a lot of paper just to describe that one. Starting with each one of those points, if the second player makes such and such a bid, and my partner makes such and such a bid, and the fourth player makes a bid, do this. All right, so it's a full description, whatever happens. So that if you have the strategy, you just put the strategy into a computer and you sit down and the computer plays the entire game through exactly the way you would have played it. That's what a strategy is. Huge number for most games, but we can look at trivial games where the number is small. So you could then say, all right, draw a matrix, a quadrillion columns and two quadrillion rows showing all the possible strategies. Player one is up here, player two is here. If I pick this strategy and you pick this strategy, have the computer play out that game, the game implied by how I'm playing and how you're playing, and tell us what the result will be. Right. Put in the in that cell of the matrix that answer. How much money I make, how much money you make or lose. The example is a trivial game, paper, scissors, stone, which has the virtue that a strategy is a single move, decide whether to throw out this, this, or this, and those show you what the payoffs are in that game. And I described briefly von Neumann's solution to two-player fixed-sum games, including that one, but I don't think I'm going to go over it again because it would take a while and we're short of time. Another interesting approach, different approach, which is for sequential games, for the sort of game where you make a move and I see what it is, I make a move and you see what it is, you make a move and I see what it is, and so forth. Not all games work like that, but some games do. For games like that, you can view the game as a tree diagram where you say, well, here is your here are your three choices at the beginning. For each of them, here are my two choices. For each of them, here are your six choices, and so forth. And imagine diagramming the game that way. And you can say, all right, we'll go to the end of the tree. We know what the last move will be, because the last move, whoever makes that move, will choose the choice among the alternatives that gives them the biggest payoff. Because after, when you get to the end of the tree, there are payoffs for both players. So cut off the other branches. We're only interested in what you would do. That means that we, instead of having at this last step three alternatives, only one alternative, the one you'd pick. So therefore, I, when I'm trying to decide to go to there, know what the payoff would be. The payoff that will happen when you do will maximize your payoff. So I'm now in the same situation you were a minute ago. I can look at all my choices, say I know what they'll lead to because I know what you'll do for your last move in each case, whatever maximizes your benefit. Pick the one that maximizes my benefit. Now we cut off all the rest of the branches and keep going back. Solves it. It's a nice, simple, elegant solution. Hopefully it worked. And I then took as my example, because it's an example of why it doesn't always work, the put the child to bed game. If the child will make good his threat to throw a tantrum and spoil the parent's dinner party, then the parent should give in and let the child stay up. But if the parent doesn't give in, there's no benefit to the child to throwing a tantrum. Therefore, the parent knows that the child won't throw a tantrum, so the parent can look at that diagram and say, I will lop off the tantrum branch in each case, because in each case, when you get to the first step of the when you get to the blue square, you can see that once you've gotten to that point, it does no good to throw a tantrum. Therefore, the child won't. Since they won't, then putting the child to bed gives me a payoff of plus 10, and not putting the child to bed gives me a payoff of minus 5, so I should put the child to bed. That's the subgame perfect equilibrium, but it doesn't work, and it doesn't work because of commitment strategies. Because you put the child to bed, and the child throws a tantrum. And why does the child throw a tantrum? Because the child, at some level, conscious or unconscious, realizes that making it clear that you will carry out threats makes it more likely that daddy will give in to your threat next time. All right. So that's the logic of it. And all of you who aren't parents will believe that you will, of course, never give in to such things, but you will discover it's a sad fact that your kids are just as tough-minded as you are, and they can make exactly the same argument and will. So, and more games, bilateral monopoly, which is the simple bargaining game. I have the only apple, only you want it. Selling it to you, it's worth a dollar to you, nothing to me, dollar gain. But we disagree about the price. All right. Prisoner's Dilemma, which is the very simple case of what economists call market failure, a case where each player acts rationally and they're both worse off as a result. Bilateral Monopoly is a two-player non-fixed-sum game because there's a dollar gain if we agree and zero if we don't agree. That makes possible threats, bargains, bluffs, commitment strategies, and so forth. And a Doomsday Machine is a nice dramatic example of a commitment strategy hardwired into the hardware, hopefully, the theory of it anyway, which now they know that if they attack you, the world ends, so they won't attack you. I argued that the hawk dove alias bully wimp situation is another example where human beings commit themselves to behave in what appear to be irrational ways because that commitment gets other people to do things that they want those people to do in order that they won't behave in those ways. And I think if you think of all the people you know, you can probably work out whether in films or in real life experience the kind of people who do get their way by making it clear that they're unreasonable people, so to speak. What do we learn from game theory? We don't really get a rigorous proof of what's going to happen, but we get some ways of thinking about things, some intuition about why we want to avoid getting into games with the structure of a prisoner's dilemma, but also why we may want to get other people into those games if they're our opponents, as, for example, the prosecutor in the standard prisoner's dilemma story gets them into that game. And my standard example is getting an army to run away. Somehow arrange things so that each soldier on the other side in the particular unit you're facing realizes that if he doesn't run away, he's going to get killed. Then instead of having to kill him, which will result in many of your soldiers getting killed too, he just runs, and now you advance through the hole in the enemy line and repeat the performance on each flank, as it were. And there were some, I think, largely French scholars in the 19th century who looked back at mostly classical battles in classical antiquity, and tried to figure out what had really happened. And part of their argument was that the standard analysis ignored the fact that the soldiers were really human beings. So that I think one description one of them made is sort of the standard version of a column of cavalry attacking a line of infantry is that the column smashes into the line and various things happen. That isn't what really happens. What really happens is that at some magical point, either the column decides the line is not going to break and stops, or the line decides the column is not going to stop and runs. And that's the normal result. It suggests the importance of commitment strategies. It suggests the bargaining costs that are associated with dividing up a surplus, as in my apple story, that it's much more expensive if it's a $1 million apple than a $1 apple. One implication is that you try to avoid legal rules where in order for the Coasean solution to work, you've got to bargain over a big bargaining range. So you've got a case where, yes, the efficient outcome is that you keep producing cement, Boomer Cement Company. The only small question is whether you pay me $100 or $10 million for permission to do that. That can be very expensive. So this stuff helps us get at least a little bit of a feel to why some transaction costs are bigger than others. Final topic was value of life. Matters for all sorts of things in tort law, for figuring out if somebody tortiously causes someone else to lose his life. How do you calculate the damages? How are they calculated? How should they be calculated? In designing your criminal law, one of the things you're concerned with is preventing people from being killed. Another thing you're concerned with is whether you should kill criminals in order to prevent people from being killed or in order to prevent other things from happening. So on both what you're trying to produce and the cost of producing it, value of life comes into the calculation, so you need to think about what life is worth. In regulation, in deciding how safe a highway or a car should be, a relevant question would be how much are the lives you're saving worth? When trying to decide whether a new drug should be allowed on the market, again, it's on both sides, because the new drug may save some lives, but the cost might be birth defects, people getting sick, you know, you can imagine all sorts of possible side effects. And going the other way, it might be that the new drug has a small chance of killing people, but if that chance doesn't eventuate, it will result in people being healthier, happier, having better sex lives, whatever the drug is supposed to produce. So you've got trade-offs in both directions between value of life and other. And, of course, in your life, you are continuously, even if not explicitly, making value of life decisions. You're deciding it's rainy, it's dark, you're rather tired, you'd like to drive to see a movie or to visit a friend or something, but it's sort of dangerous circumstances. Do you do it? Implicit, if your life was worth $1 billion to you, you wouldn't. If it was worth 10 cents, you wouldn't. Somewhere between there, you decide. I like to put it as the question, is life infinitely valuable? It's a nice paradox. Judged by private decisions, obviously not, because we're willing to risk our lives for a little bit, small risks of our lives, for trivial things like seeing a movie. But if someone offers to buy your heart right now, you will find have a hard time finding a price you're willing to accept unless you're having a really bad day. And when you turn down his offer, my claim is that what that shows is not that your life is infinitely valuable, but that money is useless to a corpse. And we indeed observe people sometimes do the equivalent of selling their heart, that is, do something which is very, very likely to kill them, I don't know about certainty, but that they typically do that when the benefit is not payment of money to them, but something else they value, such as their country winning the war, for example, or saving the life of someone dear to them. And I want to claim that this really brings us back to the problem of measuring value with dollars, which we started out with efficiency, that for most purposes we're pretty safe saying a dollar is a dollar is a dollar, but a dollar to a corpse isn't a dollar in that sense, that the difference is enormous between the value to you alive and the value to you dead, and therefore how many dollars you would give for it if you're going to get those dollars only when you're dead is a poor measure of how happy dollars make you, because we might be able to funnel the dollars to you when you're alive instead. And I claim we get around this problem by measuring value of life not by what you would sell your heart for, but for what price you would be willing to sell a lottery with one chance in a million of losing your heart. That in general, if you imagine any case where you're getting a payment and you're having a very small chance of losing your life, but an almost certainty of having being alive to spend the money, now the value of the money is the normal value of the money to you, and that thus gives you a measure of the value of a life to you. Tort law, I claim, got it wrong traditionally because your tort claim died with you, so in effect, the value of life was zero. The newer rule under survivor statutes, I think they're called, still gets it wrong because it only looks at your value to other people, not your value to yourself. And from a theoretical standpoint, the answer seems to be what are called hedonic damages, which is you ought to have some measure of the value of life, your life to yourself to base it on. So in summary, if we want people to have the... In summary, you can read the in summary, and besides, I will be webbing the PowerPoint probably tonight, so I won't read it because we're out of time anyway. Going to get hoarse pretty soon. I got another class to teach later. But that, I think, gets us to the end. All right? And if you have any questions, my email is, I think, on... I can arrange to come in for office hours if anybody wants me to. I'm pretty... Yep.
What do you bring in the class?
Your mind, a pen or paper, a pen or pencil. What I usually do is to give it in such a way that you're writing the answers on the exam. That makes it easier for me to keep track of it. If I decide you need blue books, I'll bring them. You can bring a calculator if it makes you feel comfortable, but my guess is, with not having written the exam yet, that there probably won't be any questions that need a calculator. But you're certainly welcome to have one if you want. What else would you want? Diet Coke is all right, too. I don't know if they may not allow it. All right with me. I don't know what the rules are for the building. Bring a lunch. Bringing in illegal drugs that improve your concentration is not all right. But nothing much I can do about it. I gather that's not uncommon, actually, that Ritalin in particular. I was told, I think by my son who had looked into the matter, that whether, Ritalin is what they give for ADHD, and that whether Ritalin improves your concentration is not a test for whether you have ADHD because it improves everybody's concentration. And that supposedly there are some noticeable number of people who in fact get black market Ritalin for that purpose for final exams. I'm not recommending it. But as someone interested in technology, one of the